Hello and welcome to what is an unusual edition of Conversations from the Adoption and Fostering podcast. It's unusual because it's a recording of a speaker that we had on our 2021 conference. We try to focus predominantly on adopted people's experience of identity and how adoption has impacted upon that. David Benjamin came on and he's a therapist and he shared really openly and honestly about his experience of adoption and reunification. I hope you find it really interesting. One caveat is that the audio quality is not great. There was a bit of a problem and he was in a room that was a bit of an echo chamber. But once you get past the first few minutes, it settles down and everything's fine. As always, if you've experienced adoption, fostering or special guardianship from any perspective and would like to share that on the podcast, please get in touch through the Facebook or Twitter page, or you can email us at anfpodcast@gmail.com. This is the third session of the conference, and we're now going to speak to David Benjamin. So, David, would you... Hello.
Hi.
Rather than me garble some sort of half-witted introduction and description of you, I'm just going to hand straight over to you, and if you could tell people who you are, what you do, and then just go for it.
Yes. Oh, great to be here. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, perfectly.
Fabulous. My name's David Benjamin. I'm an adult adoptee. Mike Shania, and I work as a therapist in the northeast of England, working with trauma. I've worked a lot with children in the adoption system, and I'm working a lot at the moment with adopted adults, which is really exciting. And I've been sat on adoption panels, foster panel, for the last 10 years for Middlesbrough Council, Adoption Tees Valley. And I love it. And I count that as a privilege. I also have told my story, which you're going to hear a bit of today, at various prep groups over the years. I've lost count of how many times I've told my story to prospective adopters. On prep group training days. So that's me. I don't have any PowerPoint slides, so you're just going to have to look at my face for the next 50 minutes. Hope that's okay. And obviously we're talking about identity today, but I just wanted to link identity into my story as an adoptee. And what I wanted to do to start with... let's just read an extract from a book called Mother's Arms, which will hopefully be published next year. And this is the story of the moment I was given away by my birth mother. My birth mother was 17 years old, in a mother and baby home in the northeast of England. And this is her telling me, now that I've met her, what happened. So I'd just like to read this. So was it Jack and Ari that says, if you're sitting comfortably, now we'll begin? So here we go. This is Mary. I'm Alexander in the story. Voices in the hallway. The tall paneled door started to open. Mary turned to look. A feeling of dread punched her stomach. Two ladies entered the room in single file. Mary recognised one, the other she had not seen before. The heels of their shoes cracked like gunshots on the wooden floor. Mary stood up as they approached, and her hand instinctively reached out to her baby's crib. She longed to have anyone to help her right now, to fight for her. "Hello, Mary," said the stranger. "Please sit down. We need to speak to you." She motioned with her hand towards the chairs. Mary obeyed. They faced each other on the cold leather sofa in the middle of the room, their feet together and hands on their laps. Mary stared at their shoes. The stranger leant forward. She was no longer trying to smile as the lines on her forehead pressed down onto her eyebrows. Her perfume smelt like shoe polish. The small gold chain on her neck started to sway like she was trying some sort of hypnotic mind control. "Mary, it's time." Mary sat in silence, her lips paralysed by dread. The words echoed round her mind like a shout in an empty concert hall. We've found a couple who want to adopt your baby. She paused, took a breath and straightened. The necklace fell back onto her chest. Mary stayed still. They're waiting downstairs. A startled Mary looked up. Now? You've 1 hour, Mary. The stranger's tone was now strict and cold. Why weren't they being nice to her, Mary thought. What had she done that was so wrong to cause their harshness? And then without another word, the two of them stood and walked out of the room. As the door closed, her emotions broke free in an uncontrolled eruption, the last dregs of strength gone now, sucked out of her soul by circumstance. She couldn't give up her baby, but she knew she had no option. She couldn't live as an outcast from her family. What was the alternative? Poverty? Loneliness? The utter devastation left in their wake had winded Mary. Her eyes felt sore, her legs were shaking. She picked up her sleeping Alexander and held him close to her face. This final hour for the both of them would begin and end in many tears. He looked so peaceful. He had no clue of what was about to happen. He had no ability to object. He had no choice. This moment, more than any other, was poignant to the point of agony. For Mary, what would he grow up to be? She prayed that his life would be good, that he would be happy. But what crushed her the most was that he would grow up calling someone else his mother. The mundane routine of feeding and changing his nappy was now a solemn ritual. She mixed the baby formula with the water and filled the small plastic bottle for the last time. The thought of running away with him had crossed her mind more than once, but where would she go? She had some money in a savings account, but not enough to start a new life. If she genuinely loved Alexander, she should want the best for him. And it broke her spirit to think that she wasn't the best anymore. I love you, she whispered. I'll always love you. Fly away, but don't be scared. She gently placed him back in the cot, then slid out her suitcase from underneath the bed. She could hear footsteps and familiar voices outside her door. When the time came to give up Alexander, she couldn't do it. Mary screamed like a madwoman possessed by a mother's love. It took two people to force open her grip, another one to take Alexander. The cry of grief echoed down the corridors as Mary watched the stranger walk out of the door with the only thing that she cherished. The other two women pushed Mary back, then quickly followed out of the door. A turn of the key and Mary was alone. Her world came spectacularly crashing down, her fight snuffed out. She fell to the floor, a pile of rags and tears. A part of her had left forever. The thoughts came in waves, an unrelentless confusion. Mary, Mary, what have you done? How could you do that? You evil woman. You could have kept hold. You could have fought harder, giving your baby away. Your baby, your flesh, your blood. You failed. Committed the ultimate betrayal. No way back from this, Mary. You'll never heal. He will resent you. Why would he want to see you again? Your father has won. The war is over. What is the point of living now? She lay still, staring at the ceiling. Her soul as empty as the room, not daring to close her eyes again because she knew the images of her child would flood her mind. She forced herself to stand and slumped against the wall next to the window. As she looked through the gap in the curtains, she saw a young couple carrying a baby wrapped in a red blanket. They were walking slowly across the snow-covered courtyard towards their car, laughing. They had their arms round each other's waists, their friendly faces. And they had her baby. The man opened the back door of the car and the lady with Alexander climbed inside. Mary stared through her waterfall as the car reversed and moved slowly down the driveway. And all that was left were two tire tracks in the snow. That was my start in life. Absolutely my start in life. My birth mother was 17 when she had me, forced to give me away by her father. Strong Catholic family, she brought shame on them if she'd had me and kept me. And I've met her. I'll talk a little bit about that in a bit. And that's the account that she recalls of what happened to her when she gave me away. And I was driven off. I was adopted by a couple living in Middlesbrough who couldn't have children. I just wanted to think for a moment. Just imagine Alexander, imagine that baby being taken from Mary, put into that car and driven off. New smells, new sights, new sounds, new tastes. I'd been with Mary for 4 weeks. The bond that I must have had with her was the normal mother and baby bond, that supernatural thing that we can't really put into words. And then in a space of moments, that was broken. Imagine how terrified I must have been as a baby. Obviously, I can't remember that now as an adult. You know, that was nearly 50 years ago. But actually, I can still feel it. I feel like crying now, actually, just reading that. And I wrote it, that emotion. I was chatting to Vicky, who was going to be coming after me next. So we were chatting, how are you feeling about this morning? And I've been sobbing, actually, you know, this morning, thinking about this. You know, and Nancy Verrier, you know, who wrote the amazing book, the sort of go-to book for adopters and adoptees, The Primal Wound, you know, says that adoptees are adoptees for life. And that's true. And Shania just said it as well. I wrote it down and I can't read it. You know, adopted children become adopted adults. Adoptees are adoptees for life. And, you know, I had a good life. If anyone who's familiar with attachment theory, you know, John Bowlby calls it the secure base. You know, I had a secure base. I had two loving adoptive parents who clothed me and fed me and made sure I was educated and loved me. You know, I wanted for nothing, but I never felt like I fitted in. Never felt like I fitted in. Julie said it, you know, this morning as well, a sense of loss and rejection. It felt like half a person, felt like people didn't get me, and or didn't try and get me or try and understand me. I was always the different one. I always had weird haircuts and listened to bizarre music, and I didn't fit in. I grew up in a Christian, very fundamental Christian church setting. You know, my father was very, very into discipline. You know, he used to hit me, and you know, and. I've thought, you know, over the years, you know, like, why would you adopt a baby and then hit them? I can't work that out. I might come onto this. I've only got 50 minutes. I could talk for like 5 hours. My relationship with my adopted father, you know, is pretty fractured right now. But I had a good life, you know. I remember being told about the age of 5-ish by my adopted mum that they'd chosen me. You know, that's quite an emotive phrase right now in the adoption world, a chosen. You know, a lot of people would say, well, you weren't chosen, you were relinquished, you were given away. You know, and I firmly believe it's not the adoption that's affected me, it's the relinquishment. It's the trauma that happened when Mary handed me to that couple and watched as they drove away. That's when the trauma happened. So I remember my adopted mum telling me that they'd chosen me from a hospital, that they brought me home, that it was winter, and that they loved me very much. I was 5 years old, you know, I didn't understand what that meant. And then that was it. Radio silence. It was never mentioned again, ever. And I know this is going back a long time, and I know adoption, I work in adoption in local authorities and things now, and I know it's completely different, you know, and Julie talked about it, Vicky's going to talk about it, with the life story books and contact and all of that sort of stuff. But for me, it was silence. I've got an adopted sister who was adopted 2 years younger than me, adopted from a different family. And she was the only person I had in my life who understood. And so we would invent stories. You know, we talk about identity. We wanted to fit in, but we didn't fully know how to. You know, we made up a story of which hospital we were both born in, so it fitted in with where my parents lived, if anyone asked. You know, I mean, anyone with eyes would know that we weren't related to my parents. Just obvious, ridiculously obvious. And I wasn't related. She's got quite olive skin, sort of dark hair, hazel brown eyes. And I'm like this pasty faced, sort of mousy, white skinned opposite of her. And look nothing like our parents, but no one ever mentioned it. But it was definitely a thing, you know, that I didn't look like them. That was a thing for me. I could see that my friends looked like their parents, but I didn't. And I went through teenage years and into my sort of 20s, just absolutely just blocking this thing out. And when I look back now, I didn't know who I was. I absolutely didn't know. I put something on Twitter the other day that it feels like to someone who isn't adopted, it feels like trying to comprehend it or understand it. It sort of sits on the outskirts of empathic connection. You know, it's a bit like something like, I don't know, the Windrush generation. You know, we can't comprehend what happened, what was going on at that time, the separation, etc. And I feel like I always thought that no one would understand. And so I just totally kept it secret. I had that, the agony, you know, of going to the doctors and asking about family medical history. And I remember going for my first mortgage on a house and getting asked about, you know, family history and all of this. And I just had to say I didn't know. Once I just made it up and said, yeah, everything's fine. Because I didn't know. That part of my life was lost, was absolutely lost. And so I went through my 20s, just being me, I guess. You know, all those traits, you know, that Shania mentioned, you know, were me, you know, out of touch with my feelings. Loneliness was a big one. You know, there's a quote from a book called Adoptee Trauma. I'm surrounded by books. I'm like, I'm in heaven right now. This is the period of life when the adoptee goes through an identity crisis, unsure just who they are. As their ability to think in the abstract increases, the future becomes a worrisome unknown. And I pushed that down. I couldn't face it. It was too big, too big. For most young people, thoughts of the future bring on feelings of absence. In the adoptee, the feeling is intensified and confusing. As one adoptee expressed it, how can I think about the future when I have so much unfinished business from the past? You know, I struggled with relationships, and I still do. You know, and I think, you know, again, what Shania said, you know, adopted children become adopted adults. You know, I've been in therapy myself, and I am a therapist, so, and I am adopted, so I see it from, you know, many sort of different angles, unique, I guess. You know, I think Scott, or I'll describe me as like a Venn diagram of everything sort of adoption. And I had feelings of guilt and shame, difficult with intimacy, lack of self-esteem, people pleaser, all of that stuff. You know, that was the unconscious stuff, the trauma stuff, the brain stuff that's there. Our brain's constantly trying to keep us safe. That's how our brain works. You know, when we're in control, we feel safe. You know, I'm sure Vicky will talk a bit more about this, about the therapy and the therapy I do with clients around, you know, our brain's trying to keep us safe. And being adopted, it feels very unsafe. And actually, you know, I was quite happy. You know, I joined Twitter last week, actually, and they're sort of words that I thought would never come out of my mouth. But I'd heard of this phrase coming out of the fog. Heard it a couple of years ago. I don't hugely like it as a phrase, but it's a thing, you know, and it does a job. It does a job. I think it originated in America, but I've not been able to find. If anyone knows in the comments where the coming out of the fog came from, stick it up, because I've been unable to find it. But I actually think, for me, my fog started when I found my birth family and my birth mother. So just a bit of context around that. My adopted sister, she had the same stance as me, partly from my parents. I think it was never mentioned. It was just secret, you know. They thought, I think at the beginning, that they were getting blank slate babies. That was a phrase at the time. You're getting a blank slate baby. Here you go. You can put your stamp on them. Nurture, nature, all that stuff. Actually, I was so not a blank slate baby. I was a full slate of trauma baby. And my sister, when she was about 27, I think, her birth mother hired a private detective and contacted her. You know, birth mothers in the 70s, you know, they weren't expected to see their children ever again. Mary had to go home and get on with her life, 17 years old, massive trauma, no counselling, therapy, no social workers. It was like, okay, Mary, you can go home now. Brutal, absolutely brutal. So my sister had this letter, came through the door. She was really bitter, ripped it up. How dare this woman contact me? I want nothing to do with her. She gave me away. And then that was it. But that sparked something in me. I don't know what it was, whether that seed was always there, that we just needed a little bit of water to start to germinate and grow. But actually, something happened, and I don't know what it was. And it was something happened in my brain that actually I started to want to know. I started to want to find out about my past, about my birth family, birth mother. And obviously, it's all unknown. You know, Nancy Berry again talks about this ghost life. You know, you don't know who you are. I used to fantasize as a child that I was adopted by, sorry, that was related to royalty or film stars or millionaires, you know, kings, queens. That was a real fantasy of mine because I could have been. I had absolutely no context or frame of reference to base any thoughts on. So I started to search. I didn't even have the internet. I think it was that dial-up internet, you know, when you couldn't use the landline and the internet at the same time because they were both on the same landline. And I remember someone's put in the comments there, actually, about if you were born before 1975, you had to go and see a, I think they've put an adoption therapist, but I didn't have to go and see a social worker at the local authority. You've got my birth file for me. In my birth file, let's, you know, think about what Julie was saying and what Vicky's going to say about contact and life story books and letterbox contact and all of this stuff. My birth file consisted of one side of A4 paper. That was it. And my original birth certificate. You know, the identity thing then started to explode. It like someone had just tossed a grenade into the room, and every part of me was just spread over a large area. I found out that my name had been changed. My adopted parents had changed my name to David, obviously, David Benjamin. Mary had named me Alexander John Casey. So then I've got these two identities. Who am I? Am I Alexander John Casey? Am I David Benjamin? And then it really, really messed with my head. I had to go and see this social worker, and she didn't do anything, to be fair. She just said, right, you need to go and search. So I went to the library. Do you remember those big microfiche machines that you put like a little bit of film plastic film with like the tiniest writing in it, magnified it. I had to go to the library and search the births, deaths and record, because all I had was her name and the fact that she was born in South Shields in the northeast of England. Searching, I knew the person that she'd married because she'd changed the name. This was all in one side of A4 paper. So I had a name, just searched the marriage registers for around that time, and it popped up. And I got an address. I think there was two. I think I found two people who it could have been. Went back to the social worker. She wrote a letter on my behalf. Very, very sort of generic letter that if it wasn't her, she wouldn't have a clue. It would make sense. If it was her, it would immediately make sense and she would know. Sent this letter off. And I think that's when the fog lowered. Oh, my goodness. Every woman I saw in the street, I thought could have been my birth mother. Anyone who looked remotely like me. I remember following someone, sort of like a stalker, and then actually stopping. So what are you doing? What are you doing? But it took over my life. All of a sudden, my identity had been smashed to pieces. And in this void, this weird time of searching and not knowing, and then feeling, well, who am I? Adopted family? I'm not related to them. You know, my feelings for them have changed. You know, there's no blood relation to them, but I hadn't found my birth family yet. So I was in this weird limbo state. And it was, even now, I mean, this was 20 years ago. I still feel it. Even now talking to you, I can still feel that in my chest. And the letter came back from Mary. Hi, I'm your birth mother. Wow. I just did not know what to do. My life fell apart. Turns out that I had a brother that didn't know about me. So she wanted some time to tell him. She sent some photographs. And when I saw those photographs, I was looking at myself. I look like her. She doesn't have a beard, glasses, but I look so like her. And I'd gone for 28 years not looking like anyone I was related to. That, oh my goodness, that was, I can't even think of words to put that into any sort of frame of reference or context. And then I said I wanted to get in touch with her. She said she wanted to get in touch with me. I don't know if anyone's ever seen those programs, Long Lost Families. It was exactly like that. I mean, I think the most traumatic part of that is having Davina McCall knock on your front door. But I think, you know, my story was exactly like that. And I think about 2 or 3 weeks later from getting this letter, I ignored everything the social worker said. I think that, and that's a very big trait of an adopted child, is you just want to do stuff your way. You know, you feel if you sort of give control or power or take advice from another, then it feels unsafe. And so I just ignored everything. As you say, no, I should meet her in a public place. I should meet her in a hotel or something like that. Take someone with me. I didn't. I just went on my own. I went the day before, actually, just to see where she lived. And then the next day I went, knocked on her door. And there she was. There I was. She was sat there. Hi, Mary, I'm your son. She couldn't speak. She was crying. I was crying. My whole world had turned upside down. And I think I just wanted to link this little bit, I think, to what Shania said about, and what obviously adoptee futures is all about, that every adoptee, an adoption is different. You know, the system we've got at the moment seems to be a one-size-fits-all system. That's ludicrous. You know, my adoption is completely different to Shania's adoption and to my sister's adoption. That is so important, I think, as adopters, social workers, you know, panel members, whoever you are listening to this right now, that's so important, that every adoption is different. So I met her. And then what I think Nancy Verrier calls a honeymoon period happens. It was like all of a sudden I've got this family. I'm home. This is where I'm meant to be. So then the confusion that came with that, well, how do I relate then to my adopted family? You know, they're my parents, really. You know, Mary gave birth to me, but they're my parents. You know, they did the parenty bit. They brought me up. But I had some weird supernatural connection with this woman who gave birth to me, who I look like. So there was lots of visits, and I don't think even Facebook was around then. Lots of phone calls, and it felt like I'd come home, but it still felt confusing. It still felt weird. The next piece of the jigsaw was my birth father, I guess. You know, someone asked a question there and I answered. I said, sometimes, in a lot of the cases, the birth mother is enough, you know, to find. But actually, that was that last piece of the jigsaw, was finding my birth father. And I kept asking Mary, who is he? And she wouldn't tell me, and she got really upset, and I didn't want to ask her, and she wouldn't tell me. And in the end, I asked her, and ended up asking her husband, who's not my father. And he gave me the details, and I ended up searching for him, found him. And he'd been told a load of lies from the family that I'd been put into foster care and children's homes, and he wasn't to contact me. And we got on quite well. And then I let that slip. You know, I took control of that. You know, I just felt, right, I've satisfied that bit of curiosity, because I needed to be in control, you know. And I always say this to adopters when I'm telling my story, that, you know, one day your child is going to want to find out, and you've got to let them. Which brings me on to, you know, telling my adopted parents what I'd done. By this time, my adopted mum had died. She had cancer, and she died. And I'd kept this a secret from Mary, from them. But I told a few friends and people, and I thought I didn't want my dad to find out secondhand of someone. That would have been devastating. So I remember going to see him, and I don't have a good relationship with him. You know, I really don't. I find it hard enough to talk to him about what the weather's like, never mind. I've just found my birth mother. Went round his house, and I said, oh, I've got something to tell you. Isn't he? And he said, you haven't lost your job, have you? No, I've not lost my job. He said, you're not having another baby, are you? No, I'm not having another baby. And then he changed the subject. And I was sat there thinking, how am I supposed to get this into the conversation? This is ridiculous. And I felt a little bit like I was this morning doing this, you know, just like heart going crazy, stomach going mad, you know, fire alarm feeling going off, trauma stuff. And then he said, right, what was it you wanted to tell me? And I said, I found my birth mother. And he reacted really well. I thought, wow, that went well. And he was asking me a few questions and things. Anyway, left, went home. A couple of days later, knock on the door, my house. There's my dad. Adopted dad. Can I have a word? Yeah. He sits down and he says, I want nothing to do with this. He said, this is your life. Never want you to mention it ever again. He said a few other things as well that I'm not going to say on here. And he left. And then all of a sudden, I'm living this double life. I can't. My sister had a bad reaction as well to it. And I was thinking, and I was trying to be empathic. I was trying to see it from his point of view. You know, he was thinking he was being replaced. You know, my mum had died, so there was no support there. All of that sort of stuff. But, you know, it wasn't enough. I could not comprehend why he would react like that. And to this day, 20 years later, it's never been mentioned. I'm just waiting for the day when she is at my house and he just pops around, and I'll just sort of stand back and see what goes on. I felt that was unfair. So I've carried that as well for 20 years. And this is all, this identity thing is so massive, you know. I lost touch with Mary for a few years and then got back in touch. And I sort of learnt from I'm really glad I got in touch with her and found out who I was and had all those questions answered, you know. And then some days I feel like I wish I'd never done it because it's too hard. And I feel out of control some days. But I carry this thing, you know, I carry this trauma, you know, and I know that we go to therapy, of course we do, and I've been to therapy and I've worked through a lot of the stuff that with my adopted dad. So now he doesn't trigger me. You know, every time I would see him, I would go into this, my inner child. If you're familiar with therapy and inner child work, Vicky might touch on this with internal family systems and things, the work that she does. My inner child was damaged as a young child when I was hit. When I was hit for no reason, or for very little reason, you know, I used to stand and take it. And when my dad used to come round, like even as recent as last year, well, maybe the year before, because obviously lockdown, he would come and he's sarcastic and he's critical. And I would stand there in a very childlike way and I would just take it. And my inner child was popping up and hijacking my adult self. And I was becoming very childlike. And my dad would go and my wife would say to me, why do you stand there and take that from him? And I said, I don't know, it's automatic, you know. I do know because I'm a therapist, I know how it works. So in my own therapy, I've been healing this inner child, you know, reparenting my inner child, filling in the gaps that were missing when I was parented by him as a child. So now when he comes round, I can stand up straight. You know, that trauma part of me has been healed, has been processed. That the inner child in me feels safe now when he comes round. He doesn't have to pop up, doesn't have to hijack. And I think that's really significant when we think about therapy and adoption. You know, I'm seeing a few clients at the moment, adult clients who've been adopted. You know, one story is actually very similar to mine. The others are very different to mine. Of course they are. They're in very different stages of their sort of journeys and searching and all of that sort of trauma stuff. But one thing that we do is try and heal that inner child. And it's not just, it's not, like we said, it's not just from sort of toddler years, it's the baby stuff. And often, you know, and Vicky works a lot more with children who, and I have done in the past, but with children who've even in the womb are traumatized before they're even born because the, you know, the mother is in an abusive relationship or chaotic household or whatever. Lots of foster children I'm on panel for are from that environment. So the trauma therapy goes back. So I'm still working through my stuff. You know, I'm 50 years old next year. Still working through it. But there's hope. You know, I'm just going to finish now. And I always say this, you know, if there's any adopters out there listening to this, I just want to say thank you. You know, on behalf of all the lost babies in the world, thank you, because you're my hero. Oh, a bit of emotion there. You're my hero. So I've rambled a bit. I hope you've took something from that actually, you know, adopted children become adopted adults. It doesn't stop. It never stops. You know, and you as adopted parents, as social workers, you know, you've got an amazing, amazing job to do. So it's 20 past 12, I think. Oh, it's not, it's 10 past 12. What time do I finish?
Right now, I'm beyond coping with myself. You've totally messed my head up. Just keep going till 20 past. There's no questions. I think everyone's like sat mouth open, just responding to it, really. So, you know, if you've got more to say, say it, please. We're all ears.
I mean, yeah, and I think for me it was so many poignant moments, but I think looking back to when Mary gave me away, you know, my sister had a lot of bitterness towards her birth mother. And, I can get that. I can understand it. I'm a very pragmatic person, but actually I didn't have any bitterness towards Mary. You know, I just had love. I just had love and compassion. I wish I had some tissues with me right now. I just had love and compassion for this 17-year-old girl who'd got into a bit of a muddle in her life. And she'd made the hardest choice that she could ever make to give me away. And, you know, I saw a quote today talking about those, you know, those refugees that died in the English Channel the other day. And there was a quote on Instagram that I saw that said, what does it take for a parent to put their children in a boat when the land doesn't feel safe anymore? And I just, Mary put me in a boat, you know, and pushed me off. I've written a song, you know, I'm a musician. I've written a song called Mother's Arms, and it says, you know, fly away, don't be scared. Spread your wings, you know, let your dreams fly, you know. And she said she thought about me every year on my birthday. You know, and, you know, talking about identity, you know, this has just come to my mind. You know, I grew up in the northeast of England in a town called Middlesbrough. If she hadn't given me away, I would have grown up on an army base in Germany. When I found out that out, that really messed with my mind. And another thing that messed with my mind as well was, you know, she had another son a year after me, called him David. How mad is that? Called him David, completely, you know, independent from me. Called him David. But she kept him. She kept him, but she didn't keep me. And, you know, I've wrestled with that. Actually, but you know what? I still love her, because I can just see the trauma that she went through. You know, she would have kept me if she could. She was 17 years old. Had no money. She was looking after her ill mother. Father was out at work. They were poor. She tells me stories of they had to go around the neighbours to beg for food because they were starving. She couldn't have brought up a baby, you know. So she put me in a boat because she felt that was the best thing for me. And I've got no bitterness to my adopted parents either, you know. They were desperate for a child. They couldn't have a child medically for whatever reason. Obviously, back then, medical tests and things weren't as advanced as they are now. But, you know, they'd had all the tests, tried to get pregnant, couldn't. And they were desperate for a child, and they adopted me. Yeah. And they did their best. You know, that's a big part of attachment theory, isn't it? About their parents doing their best. My dad hit me. He was too strict, massively too strict. But you know what? His dad died when he was 11. They lived in poverty. He had to look after his mother and his sister. He became a man at 11. He didn't have any roadmap or any blueprint of how to be a dad. So, you know, I can love him too. And actually, you know me, I'm a dad. I've got two birth children, two boys. My youngest child has got autism, and that's really hard. And I've struggled with being a dad. I really have. I've wrestled with it. There's times when I don't want to be a dad. There's times when I love being a dad. There's times when I hate being a dad. There's times when I run away from being a dad. You know, I do a dad's group for a foster agency. We do a dad's group every two or three times a year, because, you know, and I've worked a lot in therapy with specifically with dads, because, you know, often the focus is on the mother, the birth mother or the adopted mother, rightly so, but as dads we have different issues we don't understand a lot of the time, and you know, I'd be happy to chat to any dads on here, because I feel like I screw it up, to be honest, on a daily basis. But actually, I think that's normal. but I'm wrestling with that too. So yeah, that identity thing, it's almost hard to pin down because it's so massive. Mm-hmm. But I want to just leave that with you, I think. I'll hand that over to you now, Scott. I think I'm spent, I think, emotionally.
There is one question, yeah. But I don't know whether it's a bit removed from yourself, so maybe you can, if you've got resources for it, is what would be your advice to parents of adopted adults?
They're not going to be replaced. You know, and I can understand why you would feel that. And I guess my experience, my adopted parents have never met my birth parents. And obviously my mum can't now because she's not here. But, you know, put the child first. You know, put the child first. A lot of this stuff that Julie was saying about, and Vicky's going to be saying about life story books and letterbox contact, I get it. But where's the child's choice in that? You know, I come back to what Shania said. You know, you can't have one set narrative. There's got to be a change in the system. There has to be. Every adoption is different. So I just say to parents, you know, just go with it. You're loved. You're loved. My parents gave me everything. They gave me life. How can I not love them? How can I not love my dad? He did his best, actually. And I'm trying to do my best. But sometimes we get it wrong, don't we? But let's forgive, you know? Let's forgive and be pragmatic. I've got no idea if that answers your question. Can't even remember what it was, but just...
It fits, yeah. It fits.
Be open, you know?
I might need to reframe lunch as a slight sobbing moment, because I genuinely feel quite overwhelmed with all of that, and I think a lot of people have expressed that it's just you've shared so honestly, but it's so sensitively, and so just really, David, please go away and lie in a dark room. And if you need help, you know, just please keep in touch, because I'm conscious that you've shared so much. I know you're going to stick around, and there's some questions there that maybe easier to type, or you can, in the questions, you can also message people directly if you want to answer their questions. And people can follow you on Twitter as well and get in touch with you that way. But David, just amazing, really. Thank you. I think that's...
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
A lot.
Wow. You've sort of broken us now. You've broken the conference. We're all sort of sitting, scratching our chins and thinking what to do next.
Let's just sit in silence, maybe. Let's just sit in silence for a few minutes and just think about it. Yeah, that'll be okay.
Works for me.